Now, my closest connection with God, I think, is in my private prayer time that I spend in the mornings. And in particular, as I pray for other people, that is really where I sense a connection with God's presence. So that's very important for me, to take that time before starting the day and to devote it to that time, just me and God, so to speak, my partner.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. What do you do when there's nothing you can do? Because that's how it feels to me when someone I love and know goes into the hospital. And yes, I could water their plants, feed their cat, things I have done in real life, but it still doesn't feel like I'm really doing anything about the problem. But I did learn something about this as a scoutmaster hiking the highest mountain in the place where I live. There was one very small 12-year-old with a backpack almost as heavy as he was who barely made it up the mountain and then collapsed. After we had all taken time to see the view, empty our canteens, munch on our trail mix, we packed up and we were starting back down the mountain, except for Nick, this young boy. We said, "Okay, Nick, we're headed down." But he was so exhausted and looked so full of despair as he said, "It's okay. I'm not going. I'm staying here." We said all the usual adult, sensible things like, "You'll feel better once you get started," and, "You can't stay here. There's no other way down." He did not care. He was just totally done. One of the scoutmasters made a last observation saying, "Nick, you have to go with us. There are no other options." No response. So as we adults circled and conferred about what to do, out of the corner of my eye, I saw Nick slide off the rock he was sitting on, onto the dirt, onto his knees. And we saw his lips moving. He was praying. And the other scoutmaster turned and said to me, "Oh yeah, there's always one more option." And sometimes, when we can't do anything, the only thing we can do is reach out to the one who can do something. P.S. We made it home. And this kid went on to become a U.S. Marine. On today's episode of In Good Faith, we're speaking with Dr. Harold Koenig about how being involved in religious practice and community improves all of our health outcomes. Harold Koenig is director of the Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health, and professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University. He's the lead author of The Handbook of Religion and Health, the seminal research text on the relationship between theistic religion, interfaith worship, and meditative prayer. He's published 65 books on the subject. And Dr. Koenig will be speaking at the Faith and Science Conference in Rome this June. Check out the conference website at faithandscience.eu.
How patients cope is very important for their health and for their recovery. And so when I became a family physician, that was something that I always asked patients about. I carried that over from my nursing days. It really did seem natural to ask patients, how are they getting along? Somebody in the hospital with a stroke or a heart attack, or may have fractured their hip and they're recovering. And I was quite interested in how patients were coping. And so I would ask them, and I learned that their response was often religion in one way or another. They were praying, or they had a Bible there at their bedside, or they had their pastor was visiting, or their priest. And this meant so much to them. And they would talk about how their faith community was praying for them. And I thought, wow, we didn't get any training on this in nursing school or in medical school. But I think that other doctors need to know about it. And when I brought it up, I got a very negative reaction because, you know, you're a physician. You're not a theologian here. You need to be talking about diabetes, high blood pressure. And then when I got into psychiatry, there was even a much greater resistance to the whole topic. It's been a bit of a upward battle here, but I'm glad that doors have opened.
The fact that you're at a major research university and able to direct this Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health, maybe define what public health is, and then what kinds of religious involvement seem to benefit people's health.
Public health is like the health of a population. It includes both individuals and communities. Mm-hmm. Public health includes structures that are in place that foster the health of individuals and communities. And so of the religious characteristics that most strongly predicts better health, better community health, better individual health, most of it's on individual health. Being part of a faith community seems to be the most powerful factor that influences health outcomes. There needs to be some level of internal commitment to one's faith tradition. It's not just about being in church or synagogue or mosque. There needs to be some personal involvement as well, so that it becomes integrated into one's life, one's family, one's community, one's work, all of these things, because religion really involves the whole person. And that's how it has its beneficial effects.
As you study, are you able to identify, you've been talking about this, specifically why that works, or just that it works if you're connected to people in a community like that?
We study all kinds of things in trying to figure out why it works, how does it work. Part of it is the social support that people give and receive. That makes up about 25% of the effect that it has. And it's a complex interaction of different things that religious involvement in terms of community involvement has to do with. The social part with a common belief system that is an ultimate belief system that has to do not only with having fun here in this world, it has to do with their eternal potential existence. So these are very powerful beliefs. They give meaning to life. They explain negative consequences when bad things happen, which they happen all the time. Yeah. It helps people negotiate through, and also singing together and worshiping God together, praying together. All of these things influence a person's health. The particular group, the characteristics of the group, the peer group, tend to be healthy people who are behaving themselves, so to speak, and trying to live a holy life. And that has a big impact on your health. So there's 75% that's not due to social interaction. It has to do with the behaviors that the belief system influences. So having a relationship with God, for example, in the monotheistic traditions, this relationship is very important because it then affects behaviors like smoking and drinking and other health behaviors that have to do with diet, as well as controlling one's weight.
Because we've talked about this percentage that personal belief affects. If you don't mind my asking you to reach back to your very beginnings and what your early faith origins were, what do you remember about church or community or even a sense of there being God in your life?
My mother and later my father were quite religious, and we were Catholic. And so we attended services every week. I went to Sunday school all the time. And later on, I was the youth that gets up and reads some scriptures and stuff. I did that. And I was also an altar boy. And so I was fairly well involved in religious activities from youth on. And I saw my mother pray. She prayed the rosary, and she also, when her mother died and she was struck, and I remember very distinctly kneeling with her at the bottom of our stairs and praying for support and help to cope with it. So all of those things probably influenced me in one way or another. Now, when I got into high school and later on college, of course, all of that was gone because there were other priorities, particularly girls. And so that was a primary goal there, as well as my studies and everything. I worked hard. I grew up on a farm, and so working hard was important. But it was not until later in life that I began to, you know, as I talked to the patients, I recognized something in those conversations. I recognized as something important. I guess that was the main thing, that this was important for patients because I had experienced this from early on, and really realized that this was part of the kind of healthcare that I wanted to offer patients. I wanted to recognize their faith, support it, and encourage them in it, because I realized that might indeed help them get better quicker.
Did you find that because you're a doctor and, quote, a man of science and in medicine, that people were ever hesitant to share their beliefs about their prayer or their hopes or their spiritual experiences when they were being treated or in hospital?
Yes. Part of the beginning of my research involved doing what are called qualitative interviews. I was doing my geriatric internal medicine fellowship, and I would ask patients how they were coping. I did it in a systematic way, actually using a scale, a three-item scale. And the first question was just open-ended. How are you coping with your medical condition? These were all hospitalized patients. And then they would respond, and I would write it down. And then next, I gave them a scale from 0 to 100, and it was marked, to what degree are you using your religious faith to help you to cope? So that kind of opened the door then, if anybody was reluctant, and then they would put their mark. And then I would explore further with them, what do you mean by using your religion to cope? How does it work? So I would get some details, and I would document all of that also. At least from a research standpoint, I learned that people were fairly willing to talk about this. There wasn't a whole lot of resistance.
I'm actually quite encouraged to hear that. Now, you've had adjunct teaching positions in places like China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and in the U.S., including a visiting professorship. So when you talk about religion and faith, you are talking about people from a wide variety of the world's faith traditions. And do you find a consistency among them in the importance of faith to their health?
I think there is a good deal of consistency there. It just affects literally everything in most people's lives, particularly in the countries that I've been visiting in the Middle East. Mm. If you have a Muslim patient, their religious faith is so integrated into everything they do. For a devoutly religious person, whatever their major faith tradition is, I'm talking about like Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, these religions, even Confucianism, and it's not really a religion, but it's a strong philosophy that underlies much of the Buddhist tradition. These have almost, all of them have almost identical moral standards, almost identical. It's fairly easy to see that those who have a strong faith, who are involved in their faith community, that's going to influence their health because they're going to be abiding by the moral standards that are basically universal. They've lasted for thousands of years. If you're human, these are the standards that you have to abide by, or you are going to be in trouble in one way or the other. Your health will suffer. Your relationships will suffer. Your joy will suffer.
There are a lot of people in hospitals literally praying for miracles or healing in situations where it may be dicey. Is this going to go well or not? We don't know. Do you see those kind of things happening, that people's faith results in changes in their health in ways that are miraculous to them?
That's a very good question. What I see mostly is the miracle of people becoming closer to God as a result of their physical health condition, whether it's getting any better or not. Most of the time, these physical health problems, as we age, our body deteriorates. That's part of just nature. And we have to face that. We have to deal with it. And people, many times, they're desperate. They don't have any other control, any way of controlling, you know, the doctor's not helping them. The medicine's not helping them. They may have chronic pain. They may be disabled. Where else do they go? There's nowhere else to go but to go to God. And as they go to God, their relationship with God improves. And that oftentimes will help them to cope with the continuing health condition, which may be getting worse. It's not very often that you see a kind of miraculous healing as a result of prayer or religious activities. Now, of course, the mind does influence the body. The mind-body relationship is a very strong one. For different conditions that may be psychologically or socially related, you can see those improve as a person gets closer to God, which gives a meaning again to the illness that good can come out of it, that ultimately there will be a good result because God is good.
If I could be personal, only once in my life have I had a kidney stone, but it was quite memorable, as you probably know.
And I know.
Okay. It's a small brother and sisterhood. We hope not everyone gets to join. But having been there once and having gone several times to the ER, and then they actually had to remove it, it was stuck. But the second day, I asked for prayers from family and friends, and it was really interesting. I did that almost out of habit because of being a person who is involved in spiritual things. And the minute that people said, yes, we're praying for you, and I don't know, is this my mind? Is this? There was a reassurance and a peace that I described in my journal as something that descended on me. And through those 5 days, no matter how bad it was, I was still at peace and not panicking. It hurt. But it was really interesting to me that I felt like I felt those prayers.
Yeah, I think, again, there's no way to prove this, but you know, I think God is real. And if he's real, he's really a part of this natural universe. And he wants to be more in it. So he answers people's prayers if it's good for them. Now, we don't know what's good for people. Only God knows.
Yeah.
But he will answer them. He says he'll answer them. Just as a father, you know, in the Christianity, just as a father would care for their child.
I am so curious, because you've had a journey of several decades in this process. I'm sure your faith and your belief in God must have developed or changed in some ways. What do you feel or know, or is your relationship with God now that might be different from when you were a kid growing up praying there with your mother at the bottom of the stairs?
Listening to patients talk about their faith and the role it plays in helping them, that certainly had an influence on me. I mean, we did this for 300, 400, 500 patients, and you have that number of patients in, and about 70% are talking about their faith as you go through difficult times. And I certainly have been through a few difficult times, not as much as many of our listeners probably have been through. You know, but I've certainly had my share and continue to go through these things as I grow older in terms of just my hearing, have my voice and my vision and all these things. They start to challenge you. And so all of those things, I think, and then the research itself showing that people are happier, healthier, and more resilient. How do you not be influenced by that? That's what we all want.
Yeah, yeah.
We want to be happier. We want to be more resilient to the traumas that we have to go through. We want to have purpose in life to live by. That's where real human flourishing, a term often used now, that's where it really comes into gear there. Even if you have to go through some of these hard times, and especially during the hardest of times, because where else do you go?
Yeah.
Where else do you go? We are just not, I am not strong enough to endure what I'm having to face without having a connection with God. Mm-hmm. I'm just not able. I'm unique in that, but I think lots of other people share that they need God in their lives. I'm just hoping that people who don't have God in their lives might open up to that possibility if they want to live a more healthy, abundant life.
Having done this research, is there a way that you or Duke or the Institute disseminate this to physicians and people in hospitals where they're actually working with patients to help their happiness and better outcomes?
Certainly through the publications, through the academic publications. Mm-hmm. That's of critical importance because that's how doctors learn, nurses learn, healthcare professionals learn how to approach patients, what to do to help them. Also, training people to do this. And of course, I give talks in different hospitals and institutions where I identify individuals who have similar viewpoints, who are recognizing the importance of this. And then they start to do work in their areas.
The book Faith and Science by Robert J. Tessa is the theme or kind of the blueprint for an upcoming conference, Faith and Science, where you'll be presenting on biology to consciousness. I saw a video where you were talking about a certain percentage of belief seems to actually be the I don't know if we'd call it the tendency to believe or the need to believe, is genetic. And that was totally news to me. Can you talk to me about that?
Because of some research that was done back in 1978.
Kendler,
yes, yeah. Exactly. So he had a twin study, and he was comparing identical twins and fraternal twins, and he was able to show, he gave them a measure of religious devotion, and he found that this was actually inherited, that this measure of religious devotion was inherited. It was 29% inherited. Now, environmentally, that leaves 81% or 71% to explain based on a person's environment where they live. But everyone has this genetic predisposition towards spiritual yearnings. And it comes out in the teen years, actually, and in young adulthood. It really begins to emerge. And without any guidance, most teenagers, most young adults don't know what to do with it, with these feelings that they have, an incompleteness. They seek it in sex. They seek it in drugs and alcohol, in relationships with the ideal partner of their life. They seek, but it doesn't work because none of those things fill that spiritual need. It's only God that fills it, because that's why it's probably there as a person of faith talking about this.
Yeah, yeah. I think I've heard that called the thing that only God can fill.
Yes.
Are there particular practices or observances in your own life that make you feel most connected to the divine?
Steve, I'm pretty introverted. If you're going to publish 650 papers and 70 books, and you're not going to be real socially involved. But I'm working really hard on trying to enjoy church, going to church. I'm really working hard at it. Okay, now, just focus on God here. Focus on what's going on, and that if there is an afterlife, it's going to look a whole lot like church. Other people there worshiping and praying, and this is what it's going to look like. So I need to be prepared for that. Now, my closest connection with God, I think, is in my private prayer time mm-hmm. that I spend in the mornings. And in particular, as I pray for other people, that is really where I sense a connection with God's presence. So that's very important for me, to take that time before starting the day and to devote it to that time, just me and God, so to speak, yeah. my partner in all these adventures. I'm pretty anxious, you know, whenever I have to go up on a stage. And so I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to need a partner there, because I'm going to fall apart, you know, if I don't have some help. And, you know, it's been my experience that really helps me. I feel much more relaxed and I'm more able to calm down and listen and everything. So it's a good thing.
Oh, that's beautiful to hear. Sometimes it's hard when you're in those situations to think, I can just do what I do and I've asked God to be with me and I'll still just step into this and we'll see how things go. So Dr. Koenig, this book, Handbook of Religion and Health, you mentioned theistic religion, interfaith worship, meditative prayer. What is it about interfaith worship that seems to be important? What have you learned?
I don't think we really know much at all about interfaith worship. Mm-hmm. You know, in Christianity, we have a hard time, even Protestants, getting together in the same church. Uh-huh. And so what is interfaith worship? I know that when I go to Saudi Arabia, I will sneak into the mosque and I will worship with a friend of mine there who's a devout Muslim. And I will enjoy that. I feel connected to God there. I would hope that in the future, there would be more of that, because we have so much in common. My gosh, why are we criticizing each other? Why are we killing each other? My gosh, we have so much in common, especially the monotheistic religious traditions. I don't know. I think that the more we do that, I think that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing to be broad. I think Jesus was pretty broad, and he welcomed in people, the Samaritans, the people who believe differently. And that's how he described to love your neighbor. He said, this is an example of loving your neighbor. It's not just your fellow congregant. It's yeah. somebody who's different than you. You're to love them. Even your enemy, you are to love them and to go beyond anything natural that comes to you in helping that person. I don't know if that's unique to Christianity, but I do know that in Islam, mercy, the statement that God is merciful or loving, is the first verse of every chapter of the 60 or 70 chapters of the Quran begins with that. God is great and merciful.
Did any of your own behaviors or practices change after all this research? What did you decide to incorporate into your own life?
I certainly began praying for my patients, which made a big difference when I saw them, because I'd been praying for them. And I thought, gosh, I was much more compassionate. And of course, when they found out that I was praying for some of them, I told them, that was like, I'll do anything you want, doc, now that I know that. They would comply with anything after saying, of course, I had some non-religious patients who I would talk to, and I would say that they didn't want to talk about it. So I had one fella who I'd been treating, I don't know, for 10 or 20 years. So I know him really well, knew him really well. I was like a family member. I said, the one thing you can't do, you can't stop me from praying for you. There's nothing you can do about that.
I'm grateful to Dr. Harold Koenig, Director for the Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health, for speaking with me today. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katerina Martinic, Soraya Pearson, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production team includes DJ Cromarty, Gracie Davis, and Mark Hansen. Spread the word about In Good Faith by leaving a comment and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. We think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join us again soon, right here in Good Faith.